UK Wine Show, show number 217. Simon Tam on Asian food and wine matching. G'day, ni hao and na hu to you all. That's Mandarin and Cantonese, so from that you can tell that we're still in China, or Hong Kong as it is. My name's Chris Scott, and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. Hope the week's been going very well for you. Back to the very hot weather, well, until Friday anyway. It had been very nice. I've been getting ready for a loft conversion. That's where they remove half the house and they put another floor on. So I've been busy up in the attic where it's been very, very, very hot. I think I've been losing weight left, right and centre. Had a very busy week, spent a bit of time yesterday talking to Mikel Torres Jr. And I have a couple of recordings from that, so look forward to those later on in the year. But this week we're talking with Simon Tam on Asian food and wine matching. So let's crack on to this week's show, and as usual we're going to start off the show with our mystery grape variety. As usual, I'm going to give you a clue now, I'm going to give you a clue before the interview, and the answer at the end. So here's the first clue in our mystery grape variety. Our mystery variety is an Italian white grape variety which is susceptible to rot, is concentrated in the southeastern corner of Piedmont, where temperatures are high enough for the grapes to achieve their quite early ripeness. At its best, it's aromatic with white flowers and citrus fruit notes when young, while it develops complexity and mineral notes, and maintains a pronounced acidity as it ages. Have we think about that Italian white wine grape variety? I'm going to give you another clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The government has confirmed that the Home Office will take over responsibility for the Licensing Act 2003, which regulates the sale of alcohol in England and Wales. The move shifts responsibility away from the Department for Culture, Olympics, Media and Sport. The decision brings together the responsibilities for tackling alcohol harm that have been a long-standing responsibility of the Home Office and will now incorporate the separate function for ensuring the effective functioning of the Act. The government has set out plans to change some of the rules relating to alcohol licensing in its Programme for Government document, and a consultation is expected on these issues at the end of the month.
Small changes can make big changes in the long run. With the Home Office responsible for alcohol misuse as well as alcohol licensing now, as opposed to culture and fun, I reckon it's going to be policed a lot harder. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, a Devon winemaker has said that Duncan Bannatyne can expect to get grapes, not money, after viewers watched a millionaire businessman invest £60,000 into his wine venture on Dragon's Den. Entrepreneur Bannatyne was impressed by Mr. Bowen's pitch and came up with the full sum he was asking for in return for a 40% stake in the business. Mr. Bowen established his Topsham vineyard and tasting cellar Pebble Bed in 2000 and was looking for a dragon to help finance the acquisition of 5 acres of new land. He aims to add an additional arm to his existing business, making it pay by attracting further investors to buy vines on the site in return for wine. As with Pebble Bed, investors who buy into the new vineyard will get bottles of wine in return for their money, with the company keeping a 50% share of the annual grape harvest. Mr. Bowen said Mr. Bannatyne would have the opportunity to stock his recently acquired Shepton Mallet Hotel called Charlton House and his upmarket health clubs with their own label wine.
I must admit, I haven't been a big fan of these things. Jan and I looked at a scheme like this in New Zealand years ago, and the results was it was a bad business investment. This too looks like an even worse business decision for anybody except for Duncan. At the end of the period, Duncan will own the land debt-free and the option to sell the vines again. If you do the maths, 100 bottles a year for 10 years is 1,000 bottles. With an upfront cost of $9,500, they're paying £9.50 in today's money and a lot more in 10 years' time. With no marketing costs and very young vines, this is a terrific deal for the winery. And let's face it, having to drink 2 bottles a week of the same wine for 10 years, you better hope the wine tastes okay. From English fizz that's a bit flat to champagne that's all but flat. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, shiver my timbers, a treasure trove of 2 centuries old but perfectly drinkable champagne has been found near a shipwreck, 180 feet deep in the Baltic. The wreck was located by Swedish divers just off the coast of Öland, one of a chain of Swedish-speaking self-governing islands which belong to Finland. The wine was preserved in perfect conditions and was said by a local wine expert to taste absolutely fabulous. The champagne was dark golden in colour and smelled of tobacco, but also grape and white fruits, oak and mead. Very sweet, but still with some acidity. Experts are 98% certain that the champagne was made in the period between 1772 and 1789 by a company that later became Veuve Clicquot. An anchor on the cork is said to be a sign that only Clicquot used to use. A sample has been sent to Moët & Chandon for analysis, and if the period is confirmed, the wine comes from just before the period when the process of sparkling winemaking was fully understood. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can check out these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Old wines often have descriptors such as intriguing and surprising, but never good or great. But these wines are an investment, if only the provenance can be proven. Are we looking at another billionaire's vinegar? Hopefully not. Okay, next up though, we're going to have our book review. And our book review is by Nicholas Jolly. He's a winemaker and expert on biodynamic wines, and he's written a book called Biodynamic Wine Demystified. So let's have our book review. The book does give the overall key concepts of biodynamics as they relate to wine from a French biodynamic winemaker's point of view. For someone such as myself, new to the concept, at times I did find it difficult to follow, but this was overshadowed in comparison to how hard the ideas are to accept. Whether you agree or not with biodynamics, it's certainly true that the book gives a solid start to understanding the topic without going into too much depth. For me, Biodynamic Wine Demystified is an oxymoron. The ideas are very mystical and have a religious backbone. That's not to belittle the book, but you need to suspend any scientific approach to life, which Nicholas, in part, considers the root cause of many problems in the vineyard. And whether you agree with biodynamics or not, and at the moment I still don't, the book certainly tries to give you a good overview of what it is and how it works. Many of his comments about why biodynamics is good is geared more to intensive farming habits used by some producers and assumes that biodynamics and organics are the way to avoid what he calls mistakes, wines without terroir. The book itself is quite a quick read, 150 pages, and it took me about 6 hours to rattle through. And with such brevity, Nicholas has limited his discussions to why he thinks the French AOC system produces nice, but not terroir-driven wines. In the cellar, Nicholas discusses modern winemaking equipment and how even power wires that carry 50 Hz frequency can disrupt the vibration energy of life, let alone how electrical filters, pumps can result in a lifeless wine. In the vineyard, he attacks herbicides in a big way and blaming them for the loss of the symbiotic relationship between fungi and vine. According to him, the relationship helps vine to take up nutrients, and the loss results in fertilizers needing to be used. The fertilizers themselves make salts, and according to him, the salts cause the vine to use up more water, and having higher water levels in the plant, which encourages moisture-loving fungi such as odium. So he takes a position that if you start off with a bit of herbicide, next thing you know, you're going to have to use fertilizers, then next thing you need to use more sprays to manage it. And the idea is to try and keep things in balance so you don't actually need to use the fertilizers or the herbicides in the first place. On the surface, this all sounds very plausible, but the requirement to suspend any critical thinking to engage in some of the stranger ideas, such as levitation and cosmic energy, meant that things didn't resonate very well with me, and I felt I couldn't trust the source for anything that was vaguely scientific. That's not to say that from reading the book, I haven't made me think about it, because some of the ideas in biodynamics have a very loose association with string theories. Biodynamic Wine Demystified is not a book to convince you that biodynamics is the reality. It is a book to explain the concepts, though. With many biodynamic producers shy to talk to the press about some of the more mystical sides of their beliefs, this book gives a good overview of how and why the proponents of biodynamics believe it works. It's not an exciting or riveting read, and in some places it can be, frankly, quite boring. But I feel better for understanding the key concepts, and I'm thankful I've read the book. In the end, I rated this book 86 out of 100. While France is big into biodynamics, other countries such as Italy also do produce by Dynamic Wines. And this week's mystery wine grape variety can be made with biodynamics. In fact, I've tried biodynamic wine of this grape variety. So see if you can work out what it is. I'm going to give you our next mystery clue to our mystery grape variety. And as I said, it's an Italian white variety, most recognized for making DOCG wines in Gavi in Piedmont. According to the Gavi Consortium, the first reference to the grapevine grown there was in the letters written by an estate manager, Mondaldo Castle, in the Marchese Doria in 1659 and 1688, in which he speaks of the vines. Regions nearby to Gavi that use this grape variety produce either thinner wines or coarser styles. Have we think about that? I'm going to give you the answer to the mystery a grape variety after the interview, which is coming up next with Simon Tam on Asian wine and food matching. Let's have a listen to what Simon has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Simon Tam. How are you, Simon?
Hello, how are you going, Chris? Good to see you again, mate.
Excellent. We're going to be talking to you today about Asian food matching with wine. We're in Hong Kong at the moment, so it's a good place to start off. But there's quite a lot of different styles of Asian cuisine. Does the wine need to match the individual Asian cuisines?
I think we're extraordinarily lucky being in Hong Kong, which is basically the center part of Asia. We're not too far away from Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia. We're only an hour away from Taiwan and sort of further north of Beijing and other cities. So we actually have, and also as an international city, it's wonderful, wonderful, eclectic, mainstream and eclectic selection of restaurants. So we've been pretty lucky here. The one and only thing that I will say to everybody out there listening, guys and girls and children, is that beer is the worst blooming match with any form of Asian food, right? Take that. There you go.
Why did you give me a beer when I arrived for lunch?
No, that was just for you to see what Chinese beer tastes like. It's palate education, Chris. What we're looking at primarily, I mean, allow me to sort of further explain that before we go into sort of wine. Firstly, I need to qualify. I've been eating in Chinese food, particularly in Asian food, for closer to 40-something-odd years. And that tells you how old I am. And two, for almost half of that, as soon as I become legally drinking age, I was able to sort of indulge and enjoy a little bit more. But I should have been doing this a lot longer because my family, being restaurateurs in Australia, it's always been working with wine and food and did anything that tastes good. For me, this is a lifestyle. This is my life. And, I'm very, very pleased to be sharing some of my thoughts with everybody out there listening. Beer, don't get me wrong, I like a beer. I'm not a massive beer lover, but I enjoy beer and I want to understand beer more. But the biggest difference between beer and wine is quite simply that beer simply does not and has not the ability in most instances to give us these wonderful long-lasting impressions and enjoyment that is as long as wine. We always talk about a length of flavor in a glass of wine. Seldom do we talk about length of beer because there isn't much left by the time the bubbles, leaves your palate or you gobbled it up. So all of this makes beer just a little bit of, I hate to say it, to many of my beer-loving friends and brewers out there, just a little bit more of a second-class citizen to wine when it comes to food, when it comes to food pairing. So beer, when it comes to spicy food, it's always almost what the French would call de rigueur. It's the norm. But, I think many of us have also been there and done that and seen a credit card bill where we actually spend more money on beer than on spicy food. The reason why is because you always drink more beer, trying to sort of, put out a fire per se. So here's what I've got to say to all of you who drink copious amount of beer. When you're eating that next chicken tikka, which is number 13, all right, and that Sichuan, pork and rice, which is number 75 in your local restaurants, if you can't handle chili or it can't stand the heat, don't bloody order it, okay? It is intentionally designed to promote that sort of flavor, that sort of sensation. And I think, there are a lot of also outlets in the UK and indeed around the world, Australia especially, that would be very happy to dumb down the flavor and the spice for better sort of market shares and so on. Now, back to wine. wine, you've got many, many different styles, great varieties, the whole world. Beer is certainly not brewed in as many places as there are wines made. So that's the biggest difference. And so the appeal and also the selection of wine is much broader and wider. And I think that given the fact that Asia is also an incredibly diverse place, it's no different to saying Greek food, Italian food, of course, it's north and south. The north is more cream and meat, and south is more seafood and tomatoes. And then indeed, even, you know, what seafood constitutes, what makes seafood. I mean, seafood in the UK is very different to the gravlax and also the pickles and the herrings you get in Nordic countries. Yeah. So it is extraordinarily difficult to just say Asian food, full stop. The only thing that you can be pretty sure, wine is the way forward, and it's being, you know, gobbled up ferociously and eagerly in this part of the world. Asian food in its all this wonderful diversity, regional specialties, flavors, seasonalities, matches the wine's diversity. It's a mindless blend, completely perfect.
How does Asian food change throughout the different parts, though? I remember eating Singapore noodles, which seemed to be quite different to some of the noodles we had at lunch, for example. And do you need different wines for different types of cuisine?
Well, you know, it's very, very, very interesting. You know, Asia is just like old Europe. It's wonderful concentration of, you know, different melting pot cuisines. The fact is that in much the same way as Europe, everything is seasonally reflected. Why do you have gravlax in Norway, for example, or Sweden? Why do you have pickled herrings in Germany? Why do you have smoked salmon and smoked trout in the whole fish in the UK? It is to preserve bountiful catches, you know, in the sun-dried tomatoes. Why do you have all that? Because it is to preserve bountiful catches and harvests in terms of, you know, where those ingredients are not available. We are lucky because Asia primarily, we're talking about the tropics. The tropics primarily only has two seasons. One is wet and one is dry, I mean, roughly speaking. And then, of course, you know, somewhere in between all that, you know, the food that we have here is very, very much reflective of what ingredients available, the seasonalities. To give you an idea, in Beijing, for example, the food is substantially different in northern China compared to southern China, like Hong Kong or Guangzhou. And in the north, the winter is bitter and harsh.
Yeah.
And hence, in summer and spring, they have to preserve all the vegetables and anything that they could salt and cure. Otherwise, there won't be any produce left to eat in the winter months. Whereas in the south or southern part of China, we have three sides of water, South China Seas and a couple of deltas and big rivers and so on. Well, we don't have that issue. So that we actually are able to have much more seasonal produce, or admittedly, always kind of fresh. Admittedly, you know, in the winter months, the flavor intensifies. And of course, we all drink more red wine in winter than in summer anyway. So all of those things apply. All that is left to be really discovered are the different cooking styles and also the ingredients from the different cities and different countries and different regions.
Is it a fair say that the northern food has more salt in it as a preservative?
That salt is just one of many, many preservatives, anaerobic environment, fermentation, using that term loosely.
Is that like bean curds?
Bean curds, yeah, bean paste. Oil is another wonderful preservative. And anything that actually stops the air oxygen getting in to denigrate the organic compounds makes it a very, very good preservative. So yes, I mean, salt is one, but it's not by any stretch of the imagination the only one.
Okay, so I'm just trying to get some broad generalities for the food. Let's take something like Singapore versus northern China. Would you say that the similar spices are used in Singapore versus northern China?
I think one other factor, that be Asia being very, very small and being primarily, I use this very, very loosely, Chinese culturally minded. If you look at Singapore, the population is very, very much Hokkien, which is a province in China. If you look at Malaysia, again, Hokkien, a lot of Chiu Chow, they all come from China. The migration come from China. Then, of course, you have the indigenous, the local Malaysian, the local Indian population, which contribute the melting pot, this wonderful diversity of foods that they have in Singapore and Malaysia, and also, to some extent, Indonesia. It is kind of difficult to say that, you know, are they still the same as, say, for example, Chiu Chiao in China, central bit of China? No, not really, because, you know, it's been there for, you know, a century or two. It has evolved into, you know, and melted into Indian culture, and it's also melted into the local Malay culture and the climate and evolving all of that. But primarily, you can actually track in every part of Asia some form of Chinese migration and account the current flavors and dishes, at least the most, you know, high-profile dishes they have, back to their heritage, back to China. But they bear some resemblance, but not absolute mirror copies of those flavors.
Okay, so there is some similarities as you move through. What's your favorite dish?
Oh, my God. My favorite dish. Can I have dishes?
Dishes, yeah. You can be dishy if you like, mate.
I can't think of anything better than a steamed whole fish that is barely cooked. The protein, as it steams, it coagulates. That barely, you know, reaches the bone. A perfectly steamed whole fish. It could be a river fish, which I think a lot of people frown upon because of its muddy, quote-unquote, flavor. But deep sea fish, I'm a bit of a green person at heart, so deep sea fish, as long as it is farmed sustainably, but somewhere in between, that's my favorite dish.
And what would you have with that?
Champagne.
Champagne?
Champagne. A Blanc de Blanc champagne with, you know, fully matured or whatever, 25 to 30 years old. A Blanc de Blanc champagne. The combination of a wonderfully aged character that, you know, is beyond most mortal descriptions. And then, of course, you've got this wonderful diffusion of gas, which instead of being bubbly, is more sort of soft and caressing, that massages and extends the creaminess of this just perfectly coagulated, steamed protein core fish. And then you've got these wonderful ginger high notes and spring onion high notes that bring freshness and vitality to this combination of an old, mature gentleman called champagne. Blanc de Blanc, of course, guys.
Why Blanc de Blanc?
Blanc de Blanc tend to last a little bit longer, and they tend to preserve its freshness, and they tend to Chardonnay tend to evolve much more complex way than any sort of fine blends from my angle. And then, of course, you know, you have this wonderful silky texture of the fish. It's just absolutely asking to be complimented instead of being dominated. And this delicious, you know, soy sauce that is the flavor that binds the wine and the food and the fish together, you know, acts as almost like a canvas, you know, for all the wonderful palettes of colors, you know, to be piled upon the flavor palette the color of fish.
Soy sauce to me is like a flavor additive. It's got high in umami, and I would have thought that's more like a color, so to speak, on the canvas than the canvas itself.
It depends on, it's a very, very good point. It depends really on the quantity of how much you have and also the intensity of. And the thing is that we know that sugar is eroded out of a palate pretty rapidly, so it's salt, but umami stays forever. Yes, it does. All you have to do is actually get a little bit of monosodium glutamate, MSG, dissolve it, you know, no more than a quarter of a teaspoon in a glass of water. You can still taste it an hour later. And so that becomes a platform instead of something as a condiment or a high note. And at the same time, when you have a wine that is aged, a champagne that is aged, not just Soulette, but, you know, in the bottle, maturing, that umami flavor derived from yeast and very complex ferment equations also gives you that link to soy sauce and various other things. In much the same way as a very ripe tomato puree is just a wonderful mouthful with a glass of champagne, full stop. Forget olive oil, forget garlic, forget anything else.
Tomatoes are high in umami as well. Do you think umami and umami reinforce each other, or all umami the same? Do you get different styles of umami?
You know, it's a wonderful, wonderful question. I'm sort of really just scratching my left knee and then the right knee because I just bumped them before and they're quite painful. But I'm also scratching my head thinking what is really wonderful is that sugar and salt, as simple as the concepts are, there are absolute wonderful diversities. You know, you just simply cannot compare fructose to sucrose, for example. And you simply cannot compare malic acid to tartaric acid, the chalk and cheese. And in much the same way as I think there is a family of flavors called umami that, you know, comes from, you know, dried dehydrated vegetables. It comes from taste of yeast. It comes from fermentation, mutation flavors. It comes from all sorts of different sources. And I believe they will mutually build upon each other and layer the flavors for much greater gain.
A lot of people talk about umami with Asian cuisine, but it can't be all about that. It must be about other building blocks of cuisine. What are the key structural building blocks of Asian cuisine?
One of the things that I have not had the time nor the luxury to explore is the concept of umami in its absolute pure natural sense. We know the synthesized version in MSG. We know tomato, we know mushroom, we know even strawberries contain umami.
Strawberries?
Even strawberries, absolutely, contain umami. But what we don't know is how much umami is contained in, say, an oyster fresh off Irish coast. What we don't know, what I don't know, I beg your pardon, is how much umami do you find in a deep sea fish, a deep sea cod, compared to something that grown up, you know, in spawn and grown up in the river. I think, you know, all those sort of flavors really contribute to umami as a concept. I think umami is, you know, still got a lot of, you know, it is a chemical compound, and I just kind of imagine that, you know, it is an exclusive chemical compound, elitist enough to be in Asian food. Cream is full of umami. Cheese is full of umami.
Yeah, cheese,
right? So dairy produce. Porcini mushroom is a huge amount of umami. That's what we love it so much. Truffle. I'm sure if somebody has got enough money to buy a few kilos of truffles and grind it down and do a umami study, we'll probably find that, you know, those flavors are, you know, I don't want to put a brand on it. I don't want to put a very strict four-cornered, four-walled concept on it. But these are inevitably exist in our daily life. And I think we still got a lot of understanding to go in terms of understanding flavors. And I think that, you know, research is one. But I think, you know what, not all of us are researchers, but we all eat and drink every day. So I think we are probably the best, you know, qualifier of what tastes good and what doesn't, and what works and what doesn't, as long as we keep an open mind.
For lunch, we had some frogs, right? Little bits of frogs that seemed to be fried or something like that with the odd bit of frog bone in there. What sort of wine would you match to? We were drinking a range of whites. There was a nice semi-sweet Gewürz, a Pinot from New Zealand, and a
Carignan from South of France.
Carignan from France. Why did you choose those wines to go with maybe the froggy bits?
Well, it wasn't really. I mean, I think the biggest point of difference here is how we approach serving wine with Chinese food compared to the West, which is wine serving, you know, serving wine with food. The biggest difference being in the West is always one glass, one plate. Yeah. Deliberately, if you recall this afternoon, we actually had three glasses of wine at one point, and there was a semi-sweet Gewürz Traminer from New Zealand. There was a light and fruity red, soft tannins, not terribly amount of oak, from New Zealand, Pinot Noir. And then a slightly more assertive, at least in alcohol and tannins anyway, of Carignan, also from South of France. But, you know, it is about the diversity of flavors and mix and match. And I absolutely would say, you know, first and foremost, that I think some food and wine advocates and practitioners would say, well, look, you know, if this dish is, the dish is spicy, then you need something to annul it. I would say, well, no, actually, because not everybody would like to wear just a pink tie. Some of us, very few, some of us would actually like to go out head to toes in pink.
I don't think you would.
Oh, I was thinking about you, mate.
Actually, that's an interesting point. I met a guy called Tim Hannay, and he seemed to think that some people really like the heat, you know, the pain. It's almost orgasmic for them.
Absolutely. Well, look, I for one, my favorite pairing with the spiciest foods in the world are an alcoholic, extraordinarily unbalanced, astringent, tannic red, because it is a little bit like throwing gasoline and more newspaper on the fire. The gasoline newspaper, in this case, being alcohol and also
tannins,
yeah.
Does hot food highlight tannins, or does tannins highlight hot food?
Both. It is mutually respected. And I think this is one of the things where for a long, long time, where the West have always been looking for harmony, basically a flatness, of flavors. And mind you, you know, the West seldom cook with ginger and various other high-toned flavors. Saffron is probably as exotic as it gets, but then it is buried always in a very flat, monotone texture, like a paella. When you have something like Asian culture, which is looking for different things and is really striving for different flavors, I think those sort of things has to be respected. But at the moment, I think for most part of the greater part of China, we're still very, very much affected by, you know, what conventionally and what respectively is practiced in the West. But one day soon, I hope that we're going to break through that mold and find our own balance with regards to what we truly like. In much the same way, you know, German Riesling for a long time was not at all popular. People thought it was sweet. It was, you know, wishy-washy. But then you've got a couple of keen brands from the Mosel-Sahur that come out here, imported by some of the gatekeepers and, you know, flying out, you know, a little bit less than King's Ransom. And all of a sudden people take note and goes, oh, wow, this must be bloody good. So yeah, it's evolving. You know, there isn't a definitive yes or no and this works, this doesn't. Much the same way as, you know, you wear glasses, I don't, and I don't wear socks, and you do.
Well, I definitely wear socks. And when I'm thinking about hot, spicy food, I'm thinking, how do I null the pain? Whereas you're more like, bring it on. It's slightly masochistic.
It is quite masochistic. And my whole take is, up to an extent, if you just went and bought a new pair of running shoes, then you got to really go out there and run to earn your keep. But if you want to run a marathon, then it's the next notch. It is nothing wrong with going to a restaurant that proposed to serve spicy food, but as long as the spices are not that painful, or at least you're going to know that with a couple of the cold beers. But, you know, but when you want to go to sort of the whole hog, then you got to have a level of conviction. And that's where it really sorts out the boys and the girls and the men and those in the pink.
Okay, I think I'll be in the pink, to be honest. A pink leotard in the jog.
I will watch you on Facebook. Thank you.
You said earlier that some of the wine and food matches have been driven by Europe as opposed to maybe China. And do you think that some of the flavors that come from, say, German Riesling and Asian food are in combination? Because a lot of people talk about the structure of food and wine matching, but there's also the flavors going off as well. And, you know, a wild ferment German Riesling with all its funky aromas isn't necessarily something that you might want to go with ginger, for example. You might want something a bit more pure and fruit-driven.
The biggest hindrance to Greater China moving forward by leaps and bounds, yet another cultural revolution, is that we've been told culturally not sensitive or minded messages from the West. And the biggest problem is red wine, red meat, and white wine, white meat. Forget about flavors.
Oh, no one believes that.
Forget about flavors. But, you know, that is still a story. That is still, you know, a communication that still needs to be rectified.
Some of the rules about wine and food matching that I've sort of learned, I think still apply. But what you seem to say is that sometimes it's not, as you say, it's not about hiding the spices or managing the spices. Maybe it's about highlighting them. Because I noticed that in Hong Kong, a lot of people drink red wines. You know, Chinese people seem to be into red wines more than white wines. Is that a fair comment?
It is true to an extent. But firstly, we're still sort of basically in the middle of our winter in the Northern Hemisphere. And two, you know, when you're talking about sort of summer and winter seasonality, most of the wines are consumed indoor, not outdoor, but inside air-conditioned comfort in sort of plush armchairs and silver service Chinese and or European restaurants. So aircon is flowing freely.
So are you saying that it's less important about because you're inside, it's so hot that you're in air-conditioned comfort, so it doesn't really matter that it's summer, you know, 50 degrees outside, you're drinking red wine because it's nice and 16, 17?
Yeah, 38 degrees centigrade and 98% humidity. You know, we're all going to be sitting inside, I can tell you that. Unless you're in a swimming pool.
Yeah, true. And if you're not in a swimming pool, you're drenched in sweat anyway.
Exactly right.
Okay, just to finish up, you've got a wine bottle here in a grey bag.
It's actually a sock. It's actually a wonderful airline sock that sadly they don't, for cost-cutting measures or whatnot, don't make them as long as. So what we do is, you know, at the Independent Wine Center, we buy all our samples. We don't take freebies. At the Independent Wine Center, we're all about, you know, promoting quality minus price tags and or reputation of wine. So if this is a Mont Rocher and if you don't like it, then that's it. That's how it goes. And if it is a Mont Rocher and you like it, well, I hope it comes with a respectable price tag. And or if it was a £3 supermarket wine and you really love it, go and buy some more. Don't be fooled.
So, I was just trying to work out why it was in the sock. I was trying to work out what it was, and I hadn't picked it as a Mont Rocher.
No, it is not a Mont Rocher. It is actually a Viognier from Calera in Manhattan, Central Coast, California. But it is 1999, and it's aging extraordinarily wonderfully. You know, the 93 vintage I had with the dinner last night was delicious. And I think, you know, the boys and girls down there are doing a really, really, really good job. And it's been one of my favorite wines for a decade and a half.
All right, then. Well, thanks very much, Simon.
You're extremely welcome.
Cheers, mate.
Hope you enjoyed that. I think Simon summed it up very well in the interview. Often when we match food and wine in the West, we're looking for harmony in the wines. Simon is happy with conflict amongst his dishes to get great, interesting sensations. When matching wines with Asian food, perhaps we should embrace this juxtaposition of styles to create more angular feelings in our mouths. Anyway, almost finished the podcast this week. Just to give you an answer to our mystery grape variety, it was, of course, the grape variety Cortez. Not an easy one, in fact, quite a tricky one, actually. So good on you if you got that right. And just to finish up, this week's quote, which is taken from Nicholas Jolly's book, Biodynamic Wine Demystified, from the book review. It's not really a great whippy quote, but I quite like it. In it, he says, "It really isn't normal for AOC wines to be subjected to osmosis." That's removing water using reverse osmosis. But if it's done, being legal these days, wine concentration ought to be printed on the label. Interesting, you have to do it for orange juice, so why shouldn't you do it for wine? Although I'm sure there's a lot of top-end Bordeaux producers who would strongly fight that. After all, you don't want first growths made from concentrate, do you? Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.